Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Today is Pi Day, March 14th, 314. Pi is 3.14. I know it doesn't sound delicious, but we will find a way to make Pi Day be about sweet potatoes and persimmons and beet butter and, of course, apples. So stay tuned. That'll be dessert. Actually, our first course is apple adjacent because it involves East Wenatchee, home of apples and cherries, and now home of Bitcoin. Yes, Bitcoin, the cryptocurrency that's mined by computers. Bitcoin takes a surprising amount of power, as you're about to learn. Profiting from Bitcoin takes cheap power. The mid-Columbia River Basin has plenty of that, and the Bitcoin miners have come a-calling. Seattle journalist Paul Roberts wrote a piece for Politico magazine called "This Is What Happens When Bitcoin Miners Take Over Your Town." Paul, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So I just said Bitcoin a bunch of times without really knowing what it is. You know, I've heard of it, but will you please explain Bitcoin?
All right. So Bitcoin is a digital currency. It's one of a number that are out there. Cryptocurrencies, blockchain, another way to term it. Essentially, when you send a Bitcoin to somebody, you're sending an electronic message. Mm-hmm. It contains information about the Bitcoin you're sending and about who you're sending it to. And that message goes out into the Bitcoin network, which is essentially made up of people who have computers and have downloaded the Bitcoin software, and they compete to process your transaction.
Why compete?
Well, because eventually they're going to get a reward. But the idea is without the reward, they wouldn't process your transaction. And the fact that they're processing it means that some central bank doesn't have to. And that's the whole sort of beauty of Bitcoin, to the extent that you believe it's beautiful. It's sort of like Visa. If Visa held a contest among outside contractors to process all our payments, except that there was no Visa. It was just these outside contractors operating in this big distributed network.
Yes, and that competing for the reward so they can process my transaction, that did not strike me as being epically, cosmically power-sucking. But you do right. A great job in your piece of describing why. So help us understand, why is this so power-demanding?
All right. So essentially what they're doing when they're processing your payment is they're verifying that you own the Bitcoin, that you didn't already send it to somebody else, and that it's going to the right person. And you wouldn't think, why would that take so much power?
Right.
And essentially, the designer of this, or the designers, we don't know who it really was, wanted miners, the people who are processing these payments, to be invested in the network. And the way that they did that was to make it gradually more power-intensive. And the idea was that if you're invested, you wouldn't try to cheat the system. You would be in it. You would make a long-term commitment. You would be willing to buy equipment. And so what he did was he set it up so that you're essentially having to solve this very complicated math puzzle. It's essentially like trying to hack your computer password.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So in brief, when you set up a computer password, you have a little encryption software that turns, say, your dog's name into this long hash.
How'd you know? Thanks a lot.
Because of Bitcoin. But this it translates into this long string of letters and numbers that looks random. But if you change anything about FIDO, if you add a period or an exclamation point, it totally rearranges the numbers that come out, this hash.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the hash that gets stored in your computer. And the thing is, the encryption software it only works one way. You turn FIDO into the same hash every time, but that hash won't turn back into the password. The only way to guess the password is to randomly guess it. And with a password like FIDO or something a little more elaborate, it will take billions of guesses. Well, with Bitcoin, it's essentially like you're having to guess the password of the Bitcoin. And to go back a step, the payment processors, all these miners, what they do is they'll gather up all these messages, these Bitcoin payment transactions, into batches of roughly 2,000, and they'll assemble them in what they call a block, and then they sort of verify it en masse. And each of those blocks has what's essentially a password, except it's very elaborate. And to guess that password takes billions and billions and billions of guesses.
Yes. And whether we all understand all of that or not, that's where we're coming to the idea that it takes so much power. So first of all, this is fascinating because I think of Bitcoin as being, it's digital, it's virtual, as opposed to real world. And yet your piece is about the real world effects. People need power. The Bitcoin industry needs power. And how much power are we talking about?
A lot of power. So initially, the people that were starting in their basements, it was a lot of gamers and computer nerds that started this. They could do a desktop, and it might use as much power as a hairdryer uses.
Yeah.
So by the time they realized that you could make money at this, you needed to scale up and have a commercial operation. The first mines were like, the big ones were a 1 megawatt. By that time, by the time they showed up in East Wenatchee, it was, maybe a megawatt, 2 megawatts. Now they're asking for 10 megawatts, 50 megawatts, 200 megawatts.
And that would power, like, how many houses?
It would power, well, a single megawatt will power around 450 homes.
Okay, that's...
So we're talking, like, city-sized.
Yes.
You know.
So is this transforming the Mid-Columbia Basin? How big an impact is this having? Because, well, maybe you should start by giving us a picture of what kind of businesses are and how many are collected there mining Bitcoin.
Right. So initially, it was completely under the radar. It was folks doing it in their basements, even in Wenatchee.
Yeah.
You know, when they realized that, okay, to make money at this, we need cheap power. Where's cheap power? Oh, it turns out, for folks in Seattle, it's just over the mountains.
Yeah. Hydropower, the mighty Columbia generating this cheap power.
And so they begin showing up, and then as they begin trying to scale up, as they realized the network was making it more complicated for them, they needed more computers, then the utility started noticing.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, sort of in terms of how much you notice it, the average person on the street, you might notice that a warehouse has gone up and has a big transformer outside, but you wouldn't necessarily know what was going on inside that.
Right.
It's the people who are sort of responsible for dealing with the power, like the utilities. They're the ones seeing these spikes. So they would see, for example, that a person in an apartment was now using 10 times as much power as his neighbors are. And that's putting an extra load on residential power systems. They actually cause fires. You know, they'll cause the transformers to melt down.
Mm.
So it shows up in that way. And then it shows up in these where these power requests that the utilities are now dealing with. So to give you an example, Chelan County, it's one of the three counties in the Mid-Columbia Basin that has all this cheap hydropower.
Mm-hmm.
Chelan County's 75,000 roughly residents use, sort of in a pre-Bitcoin world, around 200 megawatts. There was a single miner last year who wanted to have a Bitcoin operation that would have been 200 megawatts. So that's to give you a sense of the scale of this.
In case you're tuning in now, talking with Seattle journalist Paul Roberts, who wrote for Politico this piece called "This is What Happens When Bitcoin Miners Take Over Your Town." And that town is East Wenatchee, a couple and a half hours outside Seattle, Apple capital of the world. So the Columbia River provides all this power. You're describing spikes and some overloads, but are you saying there's not enough Columbia River water? Is there not enough power? Is it just a matter? Is this just an engineering challenge and no big deal?
It's a little of both. I mean, right now, most of the power that the three counties in the Mid-Columbia Basin generate is sold out of county. You know, they typically use about 20% of the power locally,
mm-hmm.
and most of it's sold to places like Seattle or California. And importantly, it's sold at premium prices. And they use that profit they make on those out-of-county sales to subsidize their local rates, which is why the local rates are so low.
Mm-hmm.
And what they essentially were taking care of their own and bilking the rest of us. But it was great because it allowed residents to enjoy cheap power. We heat all through the winter with electricity, which is very unusual.
Instead of gas, because it's so cheap. How can you not?
Yeah, exactly. And we also have attracted power-intensive businesses. So you had the aluminum business show up there and across the Northwest for the same reason. You have farming. The irrigation is very power-intensive, but the cheap power allowed farmers to essentially turn what is a semi-arid, you know, almost desert region into one of the most productive agricultural areas in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you attracted data centers. So you had all Google and Yahoo and Intel all showed up in Grant County, particularly Quincy, because of cheap power. So and incidentally, because the data centers were here, it laid in these big fiber, optics, so that there was the fast fiber, which allowed the Bitcoin miners to do their business, which is very critical if you're competing with miners around the world to have that kind of high-speed internet.
Okay, so Bitcoin industry is just another business in the Mid-Columbia Basin era. Are you suggesting that there's some downside to this latest entrant, Bitcoin, being so massive?
It raises a lot. I mean, at the very least, it raises a lot of, you know, pretty critical questions. So it's the rate of growth, first of all. You know, now they've received 2,000 megawatts, so 2 gigawatts of power requests last year, the three counties have. They could supply that much if they cut all their out-of-county contracts, but it would require completely redoing their business models. It would require selling less power out-of-county for that premium price, so they would have to raise their local rates, which would completely change the economics for local users.
So it starts to make East Wenatchee area, I mean, we're not talking Silicon Valley, but you're saying it's not so cheap and sleepy anymore.
Right. And then And it also raises questions about, is this the best use for this green hydropower? Because it's green. It's like one of the rare electrical sources or sources of electrical power that doesn't have all these environmental problems. It has environmental problems, but in the scheme of things, it's a lot better than, say, coal or natural gas.
Sure.
So, should we be using the power for Bitcoin? And is Bitcoin, then it takes you back to the question about what's the social utility of Bitcoin?
There you go. Tell me, is this a mirage or is this, because I think the Bitcoin advocates say this is fantastic. This is going to be a platform that's going to, the way the money system is right. Set up now is overpriced and corrupt. And so is there, how should we feel about the rise of Bitcoin as an industry?
Well, for most of the people that don't live in the Mid-Columbia Basin, Bitcoin is this really wonderful sort of thought experiment.
Uh-huh.
Like, what would you, if you could invent a new financial system that didn't require big banks and central banks and gave you individuals a huge amount of freedom, would you do it? And what would be the advantage? So that's one question. The next question is, it turns out that, you can send not just money information with one of these Bitcoin messages or other cryptocurrency messages, but you can send whole contracts via cryptocurrency, mm-hmm. via the blockchain. So you could send instructions for how the money that you're sending is supposed to be used. And in theory, you could do away with attorneys, you could do away with accountants, you could essentially take all those functions and in-house them in the form of your blockchain.
Hmm.
So maybe you could tell your Uber exactly, not just you could give specific instructions about what time you were to be dropped off, or your children, if you wanted to have your kids delivered at certain times. Supposedly, in theory, this is the wave of the future. It can connect the Internet of Things.
Mm-hmm.
And at least that's what the Bitcoin miners are arguing today. Of course, the people who are making this argument are heavily invested in the system. So
yes.
Of course, they want it to work.
Of course.
But that's just one of those political arguments. Most of us, it's like it's abstract. It'd be interesting if it works out. If it all fails tomorrow, it's like, okay, well, that was amusing. But in places like East Wenatchee and Wenatchee, Chelan County, Douglas County, it's a real question because they're having to make commitments now. Are we going to sell our power in county or sell it out? Do we sell it to these Bitcoin miners? Are they going to be here 6 months from now?
Mm.
What sorts of infrastructure are we going to have to add? To give you an example, in Douglas County, they built a new substation for what they call organic growth. That's sort of the normal growth you'd expect in any area. And typically, substations will last 30 to 50 years. This one was subscribed in a year because of Bitcoin miners. So those are the sorts of questions that these utilities are faced with. And because they're faced with it, we're all sort of given an opportunity to ask, what's the real-world consequences of this Bitcoin? It turns out it matters. It's not just an academic question. It's a real-world question with, material concrete consequences.
Yes, absolutely. Right on the Columbia River. Paul Roberts wrote this piece for Politico called "This is What Happens When Bitcoin Miners Take Over Your Town." So you think Seattle's facing big decisions, and we are, but here the Mid-Columbia Basin, Chelan, Douglas, and Grant counties,
right.
Yes. Making huge decisions, community-changing decisions about a new and very mysterious industry. It's fascinating, and thanks for writing it, Paul. And thanks for coming in and telling us about it.
You bet. Thanks.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be right back. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. It's March 14th, not just the day before the Ides of March. 314 is a special day all its own. This is Pi Day, when we celebrate the irrational, infinite, transcendent excellence of the universal constant. The ratio of circumference to diameter is 3.14, approximately, and we began observing Pi Day on March 14th, 30 years ago today. A coworker remembers her math teacher would always celebrate by bringing in a baked pie. And that sounded like such a great idea that we have invited a Seattle baker who has become an Instagram star with her elaborate, colorful, whimsical home-baked pies. Lauren Coe, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Happy Pi Day.
Thanks. You too. Happy Pi Day.
How are you celebrating?
Probably eating some pie, and I am leading some Pi Day workshops today, local in the city.
Wait a minute. Baking Pi Day workshops or geometrical Pi Day workshops?
Pie design workshops.
Okay.
So.
But they are your pies are beautifully geometric.
Thank you.
Is it math inspired?
No, it's funny that you say that. A lot of people are like, you must have an engineering background.
Right.
You must be some sort of mathematical genius. And the irony in that is that math has always been my weakest subject. I always hated it. I'm terrible at it. So it's, you know, it's funny how life works out sometimes.
Well, do you need pi to calculate your apple rose tart diameter in relation to the circumference of your sweet potato ribbons?
If I did, I don't think it would be very helpful to me. I wouldn't get very far. My husband asked me last night, how many digits of pi can you recite? I'm like, 3.14. That's about as good as it gets. So
do you design your pies out very carefully, though? You'd have to plot those out, I would think.
I don't. And I never sketch things out. I never plan the designs ahead of time, mainly because I don't have time for it. I don't have the patience for it.
Wait a minute. The pies that I'm looking at right now, I wish our listeners could see, these are intricate. These are not sketched out or planned out in any way.
Yeah,
this is winging it?
Yeah, they're all kind of happy accidents. So I have some general nebulous idea in my head, and I just kind of get to work. And depending on how well the dough or the fruit cooperate, I just kind of move along. And then whatever results is what comes to be.
Man, I would like to live around your wastebasket, because are you throwing away a lot of great stuff?
No, I'm not one for food waste. So usually the finished products, because we've reached, you know, pie oversaturation in my house, we give them away, friends, family, former coworkers, neighbors. But in terms of like filling and, you know, decoration and garnish scraps, I throw all those in the freezer for smoothies when summer comes around.
Mm, good. I had assumed you were a professional designer, and you're not.
Yeah, I think a lot of people ask me if I have a design background or if I'm trained in culinary or pastry, and I have no training or no professional experience in either of those industries or areas. I have a degree in international studies. I started as a social worker and then eventually went on to higher education administration. And here we are. Now I bake pies full time.
No training, no experience. You don't sketch your pies out in advance. So then what does it take to be a pie star? You're making it sound like anybody could do it.
I mean, I really think anybody can do it. I try to tell people over and over, I'm just a regular person, a self-taught home cook, home baker. And, you know, this has just been a really fun way to combine my love of food and eating and baking and my love of color and art into one, you know, hobby that has just become a thing, I guess.
What does it take to be great at it, at what you do?
Well, I guess in terms of my kind of geometric design style, I think precision and an eye for detail. It probably helps that I'm a little bit fastidious, so just naturally want things to be precise and orderly, so I think that helps. And then, you know, if you're patient and willing to kind of devote a fair amount of time to completing a project like this, then I think you're good to go.
I'm looking at your Instagram, Lauren, and there are spirals, designs, grids, popping colors, deconstructed pies, I would call it. What's the pie you're most proud of mastering?
Well, I have a blueberry pie on there, and the design we've kind of coined as the Loco Kitchen signature spoke, because it was just something that was inspired by string art, and I just kind of went out on a limb to see if I could replicate it. And people responded really positively to it, and now that's kind of become my signature string art geometric style. And I, you know, it's wild to see that design kind of reverberating across the internet and seeing other people creating pies very similar in style in their own home and their own baking. So I feel like that pie has a little bit of nostalgia for me, or I'm a bit attached to it just because that kind of felt like the very beginning of something crazy and big.
It looks like you've swirled your spokes, the crust on top, around something in the middle.
Yeah. So usually as I'm constructing the crust, I place a round kind of cookie cutter in the middle just as a reference point. And then I lay these straight dough strips around where the center of the dough strip is kind of touching the round cutter. And I go all the way around until the entire surface of the pie is covered with dough, and then I carefully remove the center round cutter, fill it with some berries or whatever the filling is, and then pop that in the fridge to chill before baking.
Is there a pie that you failed at and failed at and failed at and failed at and then succeeded at?
I haven't. So because time is limited and some of these creations take so long, I don't usually make the same thing over and over and over and over. But recently, I have been experimenting with colored pie crust, but naturally colored pie crust. So not really interested in putting a bunch of food coloring in things, but I've had some good success with coloring things with beets or, you know, cranberry powder or freeze-dried raspberries. So I tried to make a black pie dough with activated charcoal, and I didn't add enough charcoal, and it turned into this like really awful, like sickening gray color. Baked it up, and it was just a disaster. So
this pie does not have enough charcoal in it.
Yeah, it doesn't have enough charcoal to make the color strong enough. So it's pretty nauseating to look at. But I did try that one more time, added a little bit more charcoal to it, adjusted the proportions, and if you hop over to my feed, the post that I am making for Pie Day has some of that black pie dough.
How does charcoal taste in a pie?
You know, what I found that all this coloring, the natural coloring that I'm adding to the pie dough, has no effect on the flavor. It still tastes like buttery, flaky pie crust.
You mentioned you figure out how to use beets to color your pies. You use something called beet compound butter?
Yeah, so my first foray into colored pie dough was with freeze-dried raspberries, and that didn't color things very strongly. Again, almost like the gray dough, but luckily pink is slightly more palatable color. But I had a chef comment on that post and say, you should try using beets and beet compound butter and beet juice. And so I reached back out and asked her if she had a recipe that she would be willing to share. So long story short, she emailed me, walked me through the process of adding beet puree to softened butter and then using that as, you know, in the same proportion of butter that I use in a regular dough recipe. And then instead of using ice water, I used cold beet juice and came out with this like vibrant fuchsia colored dough.
We're talking with the Instagram star. Can I call you that?
Sure.
Star? 100,000 followers. Lauren Coe, Loco Kitchen is your feed is called that.
Yes. Loco Kitchen.
There is a kind of Martha Stewart effect where somebody starts to feel out of reach perfect. So have you had a pie disaster?
Oh, of course.
Will you please tell that story?
So I actually only made my first pie a year and a half ago. So for anybody that's worried about pie being this scary thing that is unattainable, I mean, I think if I can do it, anyone can.
A year and a half ago was your first pie.
Yeah, and just kind of went for it. And, you know, sometimes it turns out and sometimes it doesn't. But a couple months after I made my first pie, I made another one. And I was super proud of it. It was a Marionberry pie with this really awesome, intricate lattice on top. I took it to Thanksgiving at my in-law's house. And when it came time to serve dessert, of course, my pie was the only dessert available that evening, and it turned out to be woefully undercooked. And so the bottom crust was raw, and the filling was totally runny and overly juicy, and it was just basically a disaster. And my in-laws were so sweet and kind and insisted on, you know, politely eating it, and I just sat there mortified as everybody was, you know, choking this disaster of a pie down. So took a little break after that. That was a little embarrassing, but
see, on Instagram no one would know.
I guess not.
How many of your Instagram pies look beautiful but taste lousy?
Well, I would say we eat all of them.
Okay.
So
that's good to know.
I left that overly juicy disaster behind, and since then I would say most of them are edible because, again, I'm not one for food waste. I'm not doing this just for the art, even though I was initially drawn in by the design, but, you know, it's food, it's time, it's ingredients. They don't just go in the trash, so they have to be edible, they have to taste good.
One of your designs I love, you call it Tangram. Mm-hmm. Which, like the puzzles that some of us may remember, will you describe those in case we don't remember them?
Yeah, I think if my memory serves well, it was like an educational math puzzle game or something where they're made of shapes. There's triangles, parallelograms, squares, I think, rectangles. And I think we use them to kind of illustrate how you can assemble different shapes together and create other shapes and other forms. And, you know, as I mentioned, I'm drawn to geometric patterns and shapes and things like that. So drawing on those childhood memories and experiences seemed like a good match for some of the designs that I create.
It has kind of a mosaic stained glass color cool effect.
Yeah, definitely. And it plays into my interest in, you know, bright color combinations and pairing interesting flavors together. So, yeah, it's a perfect storm.
Here's what I want to know, Lauren. What's a pie that's far easier to make than it looks? That's where I'm living.
Yeah, I think some of these Tangram ones are pretty easy. Actually, I think most of my pies look more complicated than they are to execute. You know, I do demos or I show people and they're like, oh, I could totally do that. So, but I think the fruit tart, you make a simple curd with, you know, egg yolk, some bright acidic citrus juice, butter, cook it down, bake the tart, and then basically you're just, let's say I have a cranberry tart on there with persimmon tangram. So you're basically peeling the persimmon, slicing it, and then just cutting shapes out of it and laying it on top in whatever arrangement you want. And that's it.
Got anything even easier than that? It's still beautiful.
I mean, I guess you can make any sort of fruit curd that has a bright color and you don't have to decorate it at all. Or, you know what, you don't have to cut the fruit at all. You can just slice it up and, you know, arrange it on top and you're good to go.
Can you possibly have a favorite pie at this point?
I recently made a black sesame tart with, you know, the Tangram aesthetic, and it had dragon fruit, kiwi, mango, papaya, and I also soaked some drag fruit and beet juice to make it pink. And I don't know, it was my first foray into vegan dessert, so I was pretty nervous and scared about that. I'm a firm believer in butter and full fat desserts, but was pleasantly surprised, and I just really am drawn to the striking color contrast and the pops of color. So yeah, I was really pleased with how that one turned out.
How does it taste?
Pretty good. Black sesame. It's not too sweet. And you
I love
feel
sesame.
A little bit better about yourself because it's vegan and maybe it feels a little healthier.
Yeah. Lauren Coe, thanks for the delight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lauren is the woman behind Loco Kitchen, the Instagram sensation with the intricate, geometrically inspired pies. And she's joining us here today on Pie Day. It's been a pleasure, Lauren.
My pleasure.
Good luck.
Happy Pie Day.
Happy Pie Day. Before fake news, before alternative facts, there was The Daily Show's resident expert John Hodgman. He's the guy who would make stuff up about, say, an American president and say it with a straight face.
Take Abraham Lincoln. Before every major Civil War battle, Lincoln consulted a personal religious advisor whose name was Phineas Gurley.
Now, all right, that name sounds made up.
No, that's a real person, but he got that a lot. Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, also had a spiritual advisor name of Greasy Face Q McFancy Dancer.
John Hodgman is not an expert anymore. No, his book, Vacation Land, is a collection of personal stories about living in Maine, middle age, and feeling irrelevant. He told Jeannie Yandel about why he wanted to move on from fake facts.
Part of my retreat from fake facts is that even when I was doing them, it was never enough to simply say something absurd to get a laugh. There had to be in the fake fact a kernel, some kernel of truth or of honesty or a reflection of truth. When I wrote my list of the 9 U.S. presidents who had secretly had hooks for hands as a joke, and I wrote about how Franklin Roosevelt had a hook for a hand, but no one knew about it because he was always photographed from the wrist up. That was a reflection of the fact that there was this mutual understanding among the press that no one would ever talk about the fact that Franklin Roosevelt was disabled. He had polio and he needed a wheelchair, and there was an illusion based around him. Mm. I never wanted to do stuff that was just absurd. And now when we're in a place where facts are disputed left and right, it felt it didn't feel like a mission. Again, I just did what I had to do, but it felt like the most honest thing I could do was just be honest and hope that that resonated.
There is a lot there that sounds like you wrote it from Seattle. You talk about trying to prove your relevance by what music you like and running into your 90s music hero in town and keeping yourself from gushing over how much his music meant to you. I mean, you even talk about marijuana edibles. Are you planning to move here?
Well, I don't want to have to ruin your delusion, but not everything is about Seattle.
What?
I know that Seattle feels very strongly that it is. Seattle is very much like me in that regard. I grew up as an only child, thinking the entire universe was organized around what I thought was interesting and cool. But in fact, I had to learn, as the book is largely about, that the universe is not organized around me, and that I am just one atom in a million spilling through existence. That is what Seattle is, too.
The book is basically about you coming to terms with the fact that you're not the center of the universe. So are you comfortable with that understanding now, or are you still struggling with it?
I don't think it would be fair to say that I've ever been comfortable at all from childhood into what is now my middle adulthood. But I have come to accept a few difficult truths, one of which is that I am no longer young, but in fact I'm middle-aged, that I have a beard that looks terrible and it will never look better. Now that I've grown it and see what it looks like, I realize that I look like either the IT guy for the Church of Satan or the part-time bookkeeper for the Duck Dynasty. but in life, we grow the beards we can, metaphorically speaking, of course. And you have to come to some acceptance of where you are in life and who you are in life if you're going to be anything that resembles comfortable and happy. Sometimes you just have to accept you're not comfortable. And I never, ever am.
The notion of being uncomfortable in your own skin comes up a lot in the book, and that sort of almost sneakily moves into this discussion of you calling out your own privilege. I was surprised to see that come up so much, particularly in the second half of the book. Why was that important to you to do? Why did you want to do that?
Well, it was John Roderick, the great citizen of Seattle, my dear friend, lead singer of the Long Winters, who back announced me when we were both performing in Santa Fe a couple of years ago, and I started telling some of these stories. And I just thought I was telling the story of my life, not thinking very much more about it than that. And John got up and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the white privilege comedy of John Hodgman." And I was it was like I jumped into cold water. I'm like, oh, of course that's what's going on here. I mean, the definition of privilege is in some way you don't realize you have it. And when it's revealed to you, it's embarrassing. And I realized, oh yeah, this is in some level a comedy show at that time and now a book. The central dilemma of which is, I now own two summer homes. Mm-hmm. Are you enjoying my relatable comedy? But then I realized, you know, you only grow the beard you can grow in life. And I don't feel I want to apologize for who I am in life, but it's important to be aware of the privilege you have and to not ignore it. And that there is a moment in the book that reflects a very real and sobering moment from a couple summers ago when I was in Maine and, you know, it was midsummer and I was enjoying myself and relaxing in the painful state that also happens to be one of the most Caucasian states in the nation. And the news about the police shootings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling came in quick succession, and the Black Lives Matter protests that emerged from that and the rather unseemly and dumb counter protests online suggesting that that you can't say that Black Lives Matter because it somehow diminishes the power and privilege of white people. I mean, I couldn't figure out what they were trying to say, but it was weird. And there I was, processing all this pain and anger and frustration and realizing very distinctly that I could just close my computer and walk away and walk away and not have to, and turn off the whole concept of race, because where we were in coastal Maine is so profoundly Caucasian that I wouldn't have to think about race at all. And that is an incredible privilege.
So what does that look like for you, that awareness, especially given the fact that, as you said, you don't really have to think about it?
Right. But I mean, I do have to think about it, and I do have to make efforts to educate myself. But I think mostly my job is to get out of the way of other voices, which is a weird thing to say when you're being interviewed on a radio to,
yes,
to promote a book that you wrote. You know, I have to offer what I have to offer. That's all I got. I can only grow the beard that I can grow. All I can do is offer it humbly. And when it's some time for someone else to talk, get out of the way. I guess you enjoyed hearing a white man explain all of that to you. You're welcome. There's no mansplaining like white mansplaining, because white mansplaining don't stop.
Thank you very much for explaining all of that to me. Fine. But
oh, you're welcome.
But you're also...
Someday maybe you'll have something to say too. We'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
So, but it's a delicate balance because, you know, there's part of me that literally would like to just disappear into the woods. You know, white culture has imagined of itself default humanity against which every other culture, race, religion, creed, whatever, personhood is considered exotic or strange or other. That's all changing, right? Whiteness is facing a midlife crisis because we know, if we don't know, we sense that we're no longer going to be a majority culture in this nation. We're soon going to be a minority among many. And people that are having a hard, it's just like middle-aged dads who want to admit they're still cool. Like, you know, like there's like, you know, white people who fight against what is inevitable, which is the increasing diversity of this nation. They're as sad as a dad buying a Bentley. It's so sad. When those awful dudes marched in Charlottesville chanting, "Jews will not replace us, you will not replace us," like, I felt a really horrible, dark, middle-aged white guy echo whenever I meet a young comedian, which is, you're not going to replace me. I still got jokes. Mm. Fact is, we'll all be replaced. And there's a value in getting out of the way. And part of me wishes I could just get out of the way and disappear into Maine, into the darkness, and maybe I should. But I still have things I want to say, and I still have bills to pay. So you're going to get some of this anyway.
John Hodgman talking with KUOW's Jeannie Yandel. His book is Vacation Land, True Stories from Painful Beaches. Thanks for listening today. The show is made for you by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jima Brempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Coming up tomorrow, remember growing up, the neighbor kid who had all the best video games? Usually had the best snacks, too. You can go there again this weekend at Paul Allen's Living Computers Museum. They've got a new exhibit called Totally 80s Rewind. And GeekWire's Kurt Schlosser is going to give you a tour on the next record. Noon till 1 tomorrow on KUOW 94.9.